Now we are.
Now we are, right? Okay. Good evening, and welcome to the September 2019 meeting of the County of San Luis Obispo Health Commission. We will call the meeting to order, and our first order of business will be to hear any public comment. If there are persons desiring to speak on any issues that are not on our agenda this evening but are of the scope of interest of our Health Commission, please come forward. Seeing no one jumping up out of their seats and coming forward, we'll go ahead and move on with our agenda for this evening. So we are extremely pleased this evening to have with us three young women from Paso Robles High School who are our 2019 Skills USA Competition National Silver Medalists. So let me just start by telling you a little bit about what Skills USA is. It is a national membership association serving high school, college, and middle school students who are preparing for careers in trade, technical and skilled service occupations, including health occupations, and for furthering their education. Skills USA is a partnership of students, teachers, and industry working together to ensure America has a skilled workforce. And we are very aware of what we don't have here in this county as far as that goes. So Skills USA helps each student excel in their field. So at Paso Robles High School, through their career technical education, they have, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Ms. LaMandula, there are 9 what I would call tracks. 2 of them are in health-related fields, and our presenters this evening are in one of those health-related fields. They are Hannah Lowry, Zoe Murphy, and Maisie Ross. They were, as I said, the silver medalists in the Career Pathway Showcase for Health Services. They're going to share with us this evening their presentation, why they are the silver medalists. So come up, girls.
Hi, I'm Maisie Ross.
I'm Hannah Lowry.
And I'm Zoe Murphy.
And we're here tonight with Brains Before Gains. As you were talking about earlier, at our high school, we do have a health service pathway. And up here, these are the classes that our high school offers. And we have taken all of them. And Zoe here, our junior on the team, is currently enrolled in the capstone class. Hannah and I have completed the community healthcare practicum class. And so this is about our team. We all go to Paso Robles High School, and Hannah and I are seniors at Paso, and Zoe's a junior. And within our practicum class, we have sites, and this is where we go out into the community and complete hours within our designated field, which is healthcare. I myself did this class last year, and I was at San Luis Sports Therapy. Hannah, this is her second year at Twin Cities Community Hospital, and Zoe has 2 sites. She's currently at Twin Cities Community Hospital, and she is also part of the San Luis Obispo Ambulance Discovery Program.
So for our journey to nationals, we first learned, we attained our knowledge from the health science and medical tech technology classes, which were introduction to healthcare, sports medicine, and then now we're in the practicum. And then we took our knowledge and created our Brains Before Gains program, and then we used our program to compete in Skills USA. In our sports medicine class, we covered sports-related head injuries, which included concussions, second impact syndrome, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. We went over all of these head injuries. We went over their mechanism of injury, signs and symptoms, treatment, and prevention.
Brains Before Gains is a program that's dedicated to spreading awareness and information to high school athletes, parents, and coaches. And again, like Zoe said, we go over concussion, second impact syndrome, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Us as a group and the whole entire healthcare pathway has decided that this is a huge priority to cover among high school athletes. And so we've used healthcare professional mentors in our community to help us with our presentation and make sure all of our facts that we're giving out to all of the athletes and parents and coaches are correct. So one of them would be Ms. Shelby Lamandola over there. And then we've also used San Luis Team Movement for Life and our athletic trainer at the high school. So from our program, we have interviewed and we've created a post-presentation survey that provides us with information about how our program's doing and if it's effective and efficient. And up there is a quote from a softball player that we presented to saying that it really touched her and helped her realize what she's at risk for. And we also found that 100% of students recommend Brains Before Gains be presented to all high school athletes, which is really huge for our program, showing that it is like athletes really appreciate it and like enjoy knowing the information.
So if you guys would like to learn more about our program, we have our website, which we used our graphic designing skills to create. And we have many features on our website to like get to know our program. We also have our Instagram, which we use as a way to involve the community in our journey.
So again, this is just a slide over what Skills USA is, and it's just students competing in career technical education competitions. So it can range from welding to healthcare to anything, honestly, cosmetology. And it's just preparing students for real work beyond high school. So our specific competition was Career Pathway Showcase in Health Services. So you must create a project that benefits your community and then take it to your community and then bring it to Skills USA and show how it was effective in your community.
In this competition, the judges, they scored us on how well we attained the knowledge on our topic, how we demonstrated a technical skill, and if we had good presentation skills, how we integrated business and industry, how we impacted the community, and overall how we explained our overall effect.
Skills USA works in three different levels. So first we have the regional competition, and then after that comes state, and then the final capstone is nationals. Beyond that, there is like a selective program for the world. But at our regional competition, Brains Before Gains took gold. So that's just within the region. The way they divide up schools are in some weird fashion, but we had a lot of people in like the valley. And so Paso, it was held at Paso and we got gold there. And then after that, you're moved on to the State of California competition where we also got gold. And those are all the top regional competitors at the State of California. And only gold medalists advance on to the national level. So once we got the gold at the State of California, we did move on to the national level. And there, as before, it's all the top competitors from the level underneath, so state. And we got silver at the national level. Brains Before Gains, as Hannah was saying earlier in our statement, we prioritize youth safety in athletics in all aspects, but especially head safety. Being athletes ourselves, we've seen how it's pushed under the table when players get hurt or when a coach sees something, and it's not a priority within our community. And our goal is to engage that community and push for a mutual desire to keep our athletes safe. And collectively, we would like to ask for help if this is also a priority for this commission to push our program and to help the community see the effects of these head injuries within our athletes and to take it more seriously because there are lifelong altering effects. And as a group, we would like to spearhead that and create change within our community.
That's the end of our slideshow.
Good, wonderful. Congratulations. I see why you were the silver medalist. So tell us, have you taken this program to other schools in our county or just presented it to the athletes at Paso?
Yeah, so we have presented it to athletes at Paso Robles High School. We do specific groups, like the varsity teams or the JV teams of certain sports. But we also had an opportunity earlier on to go to Morro Bay High School and present to their athletic training class. Their pathway is slightly different than ours, but we did have an opportunity to go present it to their class. And as well at the national level for SkillsUSA, we had like joint applications for our program, and we did pass those out to our competition because they're in the same field as us, which was healthcare. So we passed those along too, and they filled out applications. So yeah, we have reached further beyond Paso Robles High School.
And what kinds of things do you tell the athletes?
We go over the signs and symptoms of each of the head injuries, which is concussion, second impact syndrome, and chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And we also pass out these little cards that have the steps to recovery of a concussion so that athletes have it as a reminder. And it has the information of the head athletic trainer at their high school on there so that in case they need to contact them while they're at home or they can't find it on the high school's website, they have an easy little card. And we go over prevention for things like for second impact syndrome. If you think you have a concussion, go to your athletic trainer and report it. Tell someone that you think you have a concussion because you don't want to have second impact syndrome. And just like talking about that, and we also talk about treatment for all of them, saying you have to go through the steps to heal your concussion before you can return to play. It's not something where if you had a concussion, you're like, I don't want to miss this game, like I'm going to go back in. That's not okay. And it's not legal either. You need to sit out and wait. And so we're just trying to tell athletes that one game is okay to miss versus an entire season, and that it's not something that should just be pushed aside.
And how did you go about reaching all the athletes? Because I know fall was like football and what, maybe soccer? And then spring, we have different sports and that. So did you do it more than once throughout the year? Or how did you make sure that you were reaching as many athletes as you could?
So we started out reaching out individually to some high school's coaches because our administration at the high school and our principal has not allowed us to do like mass meetings because our school has fall, winter, and spring sport meetings so that each like group of teams can all get together. But we're trying to go through administration and get things approved so that we can go to those meetings and present at those meetings. So far we've only been allowed to present to whatever teams say yes, we come listen to your things. We're just in the process of having the principal listen to us. So we've gone to a few board meetings with our administration and we're trying to get it approved to make sure that our presentation can be presented.
And how were you received by those coaches? Were they anxious to have you come? Was there feedback at all from them?
Yeah, so luckily the coaches were really eager to see our presentation, and they were glad that we're doing it, which is, like I said before, some coaches in the high school field will, like I said, push it under the table or not want to hear about it. But personally, I was the one who emailed them and reached out to these coaches to see if they would be willing to bring their athletes in. And across the board, I had great responses and 100% willingness of those coaches to bring not only their varsity teams in, but their JV and their freshman teams in. So it was a whole program matter.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. So one last question for me, and then I'll open it up and let the rest of you guys ask some questions, too. So are you going to do SkillsUSA this year? Can you do the same presentation, or once you win, that's it?
Well, I believe, isn't it only first place that can't? I believe that
can't
it's
repeat?
First
okay.
place that can't compete again, but like Hannah and I, we're in the practicum class, so we have to compete in SkillsUSA for a part of our class, but okay. Maisie over here doesn't have to. And, but I'm not sure about what they want to do, but I want to do like CPR first aid, like some form of like a skill opposed to like a presentation. But what do you want to do?
I'm not quite sure yet. I'm thinking of like job portfolio or like, I forget the name of it. It's like healthcare portfolio. But I wouldn't take this again because it like docks you points. Like the judges are all the same, so we wouldn't try to take this exact presentation back, even if we made it better. So like we could all go back together and do Career Pathway Showcase again, but we would create something else besides Sprints Before Games.
So is there any opportunity for you to take this program and make it a best practices, if you will, that other schools could just take and use themselves?
Yeah, that's our plan with the join application, is to like meet with other high schools through email, Skype, whatever, and contact them or go to their high school and like create a team of the healthcare students at their high school and make sure they know the knowledge, and then provide them with all of our materials and say, reach out to your administration, reach out to your coaches at your high school and present to them. So that's our plan right now. And we're also thinking about creating this into a nonprofit organization. So we have Mr. Candidate at our high school turned our Skills USA region into a nonprofit organization so that kids wouldn't have to pay as much to compete. So we're going to talk to him and like talk to other people. And there's something at Cal Poly that helps students create programs like this. So we're going to get in contact with a lot of people. And that's our plan right now.
We have a Cal Poly person on the commission here that is shaking her head over there. So good. All right. Other commissioners who might have questions. Catherine.
Wonderful presentation. You are fantastic examples of young people. And as I was listening to you, it occurred to me that mother, grandmother, when my son was in football in high school, his actual pediatrician was the team doctor. And I was wondering if you talked to any of the team doctors or any of the local pediatricians about this, and have you asked if you can actually attend the games to sort of monitor the kinds of trauma that's going on at the games?
So we have been in contact with local healthcare providers, but one thing that we have done to get an insight on these injuries is we actually were able to interview a second impact syndrome survivor locally in our county. And as far as observations, I would say that was the furthest that we've gone. Although our class is part in connection with our athletic trainer at this school, so if you're in that practicum class and if you desire to see those athletes on the field and, like you said, record or monitor how everything's happening, then you can actually enroll with our athletic trainer and do hours through her. So set aside from our program, our class and pathway at the high school does allow that, which is another cool option because healthcare has a very broad spectrum, and one of those is the athletes and seeing it at that playing field, and we are fully accessible to that.
Great. Another aspect I thought about was the parents, and boy, are they key. Have you introduced this idea, this program, to parents, and are they on board with it? I'm thinking of the athletes' parents.
Oh, yeah. So the thing with how we've presented to athletes so far was because it was just the coaches saying, yes, I'll bring my athletes in during practice or at the end. So we haven't been able to, like right in front of parents give it, but that's part of our plan with giving it at the fall, winter, spring meetings, is because parents and athletes go to that. So once our high school says yes, you can present there, then we'll have athletes, parents, and coaches. But we're just trying to go through all the approval process through that.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Anybody else? Amy?
Thank you guys so much. This is fantastic. The kind of skills you guys acquired to put together this kind of program is phenomenal. I do have a question. I saw that you identified some sites that you were based at, Twin Cities and sports therapy. How was this information sort of fed back to them, and kind of feedback, and how was it received?
So personally, I was the intern at San Luis Sports Therapy, and learning what I did in the classroom through my sports medicine class was directly applied in the therapy setting. The therapist that I was shadowing did work with athletes who were returning to play. So in the concussion protocol, there are multiple steps to get back into the classroom and to get back onto your field or court or whatever it may be. So I got to work with an athletic trainer, Miss Maria, at our high school, as well as the physical therapist, and to see, like she was saying, to record and watch and see the processes of coming back. And I thought that that was super interesting, because learning in a classroom is one thing, but our pathway does allow you to go further than the classroom and be at that site, and you really get to see what's happening. And it helps our program because now we have a deeper insight and we are able to educate our community at a bigger degree.
And for me, working in radiology at Twin Cities, a lot of athletes come in, but it like might not necessarily be a head injury. But I've talked to radiologist techs, radiologists, orthopedic surgeons, and I've told them about this and actually invited some people, but they're all working, so they couldn't come. But they all thought it was like super amazing what we're doing. And they're like, they all have kids who play sports, and they're like, that's something I want my kids to hear. And like them also being healthcare providers, are like, yeah, that's something no one really talks about. Or people come in, they're like, I think my kid has a concussion, but I have no idea. I don't know where to go to report it. Like, so that's something I've seen at the hospital.
Great. Thank you, guys.
Candace?
First, I want to say congratulations. It's awesome. I think you guys are kind of stealing the Cal Poly Learn by Doing. It's a great, great program, and you are excellent. I have one informational question just from my ignorance, and perhaps I'm the only one here that doesn't know what second impact syndrome is.
Okay, so when you get a concussion, like, so there's the neurons in your brain, right? So then when you get a like concussive blow, the neurons in your brain are going to stretch and cause metabolic change in your brain. Mm-hmm. So then basically second impact syndrome is where your concussion, or let's say the athlete, they get a concussion during a game, and then they go sit out for a little bit, and then they're like, no, I'm fine, let me just go back in the game. They go back in the game, get another like concussive blow or subconcussive blow, and it'll like the metabolic change will cause blood to rush to your brain and like swell. So then you basically just, it's like you go, I don't know how to explain it. Like, you want to take over? Like,
yeah, so as she was saying, the blood like, rushing to your brain and everything, it causes something very life endangering. And those athletes, the first responders, are critical. Mm-hmm. Getting the athlete into a safe position and being able to automatically go into surgery to release the swelling from that brain is 100% critical, because if that doesn't happen, it's deadly, as we know, and many people do not survive from this. So it is, like she was saying, just super fast, and the athletic trainer or whoever it may be on site on the sideline who has to report this, it's a very fast process.
So that means it's really important for the first impact to be recognized and then make sure that, yes, like you were saying, the, yeah, person doesn't go back in.
Exactly.
Cool. The other thing I would say, just in the interest of getting your presentation out to more people as you're going through that approval process, I can't speak for the whole health commission, but I'm happy to endorse that. And if a letter is helpful in any way, just reach out.
Thank, yeah, you. Thank you.
So I think unanimously we would certainly love to endorse your program. So let me work with Ms. Shelby and Dr. Borenstein and see what we can do to help and endorse that program. I'm anxious for everybody in the county to hear it, quite frankly.
Thank you. That means a lot to,
yeah,
us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You're welcome. And, you know, parents are important. You know, I don't know what they do at PTA anymore, if they even have PTA. I'm beyond that point. But there's got to be some kind of parent organization or whatever. So maybe we can help you identify some groups that, you know, so that it can be very broad-based in the whole spectrum of everything. But without a doubt, we all wish you the very best, and congratulations again. It was a dynamic program. Thank you for coming and sharing it with us.
Thank you for letting us come.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Our pleasure. You're welcome. Thank you. Great. And as we all know that we have a healthcare workforce issue in our county, I think it's great that in our high schools we are starting to train some of these. I'm a great advocate of that. So moving on to our next item on our agenda, we have a topic that's been in the national news a lot lately, and so I'm going to ask Commissioner Campbell to introduce our speaker in our program.
We scheduled this program several months ago for this date, and it turns out to be extremely timely given the sudden recognition of pulmonary injury from various vaping products. So this is the time to act, I think. And our speaker is Inger Epaniadis. She's a program manager of the tobacco control program for the county. I've worked with her and her staff a little bit on this, and they just do a bang-up job getting the information out and supporting various groups that want to move on this. So I'm excited to hear what's new, Inger.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for inviting me to speak today. We have a full plate ahead of us. My name is Inger Epaniadis. I'm the program manager for tobacco control at the County Public Health Department. I work with other four health education specialists. And what we do at the County Tobacco Control Program is we focus on prevention through policy. We work with our partners at Behavioral Health and the County Office of Ed to support education in the classrooms, but the focus of our program is to look at policy and how that can improve health outcomes throughout the county. So one of our initiatives would be supporting smoke-free environments, working with local jurisdictions to work through implementation planning and advise on signage and other considerations. We also focus on youth access to tobacco and work in shaping the retail environment. We partner with the county sheriff's office to do compliance checks in our tobacco retailers in the unincorporated areas. And then our program also offers cessation classes for adults who are working to quit smoking. That's a quick overview of our program and what we do. So my presentation today is on policy solutions to address youth vaping. I was here about a month ago, I believe, presenting to the Health Commission with my colleague Kim Mott from the Prevention and Outreach Unit on the youth vaping epidemic, what we were seeing in the schools, what is an e-cigarette, just going over some of the basic what we knew about the products. Today I'm going to focus more on the solution. So again, this was our presentation last year, the new face of tobacco. So a few points of clarification as we dive in. I'm going to talk about e-cigarettes today. They're also known as vape pens, vaporizers, a whole swath of names. But they are regulated as tobacco products, and also when I talk about smoking or vaping, under California state law, they're one and the same, so I might use those interchangeably at some point. We also call these products by their brand name. So, for instance, Juul, Soarin, those are some of the devices we see in the schools. I'm going to pick on Juul a lot just because they hold the majority of the e-cigarette market, and we have the most information about them. And then one last point of clarification. California is a tobacco 21 state, so the minimum sales age is 21 in California. But assuming that kids can't get their hands on these products because the sale age is 21 is like assuming that everyone follows the 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. So last year, the Truth Initiative put out a survey, a national survey, asking kids where they got their Juul devices. 71% said they got them from a local physical retailer. 52% said they got them from a social source, such as another friend or even an older sibling or parent. And 6% said they purchased them online. So we hear a lot anecdotally that kids are getting these online, but all of the surveys that I've seen, in addition to this Truth Initiative survey, show that kids are readily available, able to access these from local retailers. And also, again, with our compliance work we do at the County Sheriff's Office, we know that local retailers are selling these products to our youth. In November of last year, there was a report that came out from the Center for Disease Control and Prevention that showed there was a significant increase in youth vaping from 2017 to 2018. This sparked the Surgeon General to use the E word, epidemic. There had been a 78% increase in use among high school students. This is also a significant issue in our middle schools and in our elementary schools as well. So I'm often going to quote what we know about youth use at the high schools, but it's definitely an issue in our primary schools as well. So when this data came out from the National Youth Tobacco Survey, the next headline was that the FDA plans to ban flavored e-cigarette sales in stores. So we had a problem, and the first solution to be posed was to look at the role that flavorings are playing in these devices, or in addicting youth and using these products. I heard this analogy last week from the Centers for Disease Control. It's like leading a horse to water. So advertising, or in this case, social media, is getting teens interested in this subject. It's leading the horse to the water. Flavoring is getting the horse to drink, and nicotine is getting the horse to come back time again. So flavoring plays a key role in this epidemic. It's the primary cause for initiation among teens who vape. There's a lot of statistics that back this up. 97% of current youth who have used a flavored product in the past month. 70% of youth say they use them because they come in flavors they like. And then one other statistic I want to cite is that more than half of high school e-cigarette users are using a mint and menthol flavored e-cigarette. And I'm going to come back to this in another couple slides. But mint and menthol is the number one Juul flavoring, and down at the very bottom, the least popular Juul flavoring is actually Virginia tobacco. So nobody wants to use a Juul if it tastes like tobacco. A little bit of history. Back in 2009, there was a Family Smoking Prevention and Tobacco Control Act passed by Congress. When we talk about tobacco products, this is the family: cigarettes, e-cigarettes, cigars, chew, hookah, cigarillos. Those are all considered tobacco products. The Family Smoking and Prevention and Tobacco Control Act banned the sale of flavored cigarettes, with an exception for mint and menthol. If you think about the timeline, e-cigarettes entered the U.S. market in about 2007, and then Juul came in 2016. So they came in after this Family Smoking Prevention Act, and this kind of created a loophole where cigarettes are the only tobacco product that have limitations on the availability of flavors. So where are we now? This is a graphic that shows monthly e-cigarette sales in millions from 2015 to 2019. The top blue line is the entire e-cigarette market. The teal shaded area that takes off towards the right-hand side is Juul alone. So you can see that they make up a significant or majority of the market. As we're starting a new school year, we still don't have a solution in place for this epidemic. Why are we worried? Well, if you overlay that market data with teen vaping rates, we see that since the report came out last year in 2018 with 21% of high school students using these vaping products, the sales data has only continued to climb. So now we're going to wait another couple months for the next round of school surveys to come out, and it's likely to be higher than it was last year. This isn't an issue that seems to be going away anytime soon, and so I think local action's needed to take care of this. So I'm going to go through what's happening at the federal, state, and local levels. What's happening in Washington, D.C.? Well, as I mentioned, in 2009, this Family Smoking Act was passed with bipartisan support. It's taken a while for the FDA to develop a game plan. In 2016, the FDA finally they came out with this deeming regulation to say, okay, yes, we have a plan for regulating e-cigarettes. In 2018, several health groups, including the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Cancer Society, American Lung Association, Heart Association, filed suit against the FDA because they weren't acting fast enough. 2019, the FDA finalized its guidance for pre-market review. So just this year, the FDA has said, okay, we're ready to review these products. Please submit your applications. These companies have until 2022 to submit their products for review. So I think the takeaway from this is that the FDA kind of has their hands tied. On one side, they're facing pressure from the tobacco companies, the e-cigarette companies, who are dragging their feet. They're likely to file their own suits against these regulations. And then you have the public health community filing suits against the FDA as well. So they're getting it from both sides. Here's another timeline that looks at pre-regulation and post-regulation. So the FDA, again, as I mentioned, in 2016, came out with this regulatory plan, and they started issuing nasty letters to the e-cigarette companies. They've held hearings on Capitol Hill with Juul at the center, the CEO saying he's sorry for kids in our country getting addicted to these products. That wasn't their intent. And even with all this bad press, sales have continued to climb. And then I want to note, you know, just that last point there in January 2019 when Altria, one of the largest tobacco companies in the U.S., bought a 35% stake in Juul. What's happening in Sacramento? Well, we had a glimmer of hope that this flavored tobacco loophole would be closed with Senate Bill 38, which was introduced just after the CDC came out with their youth vaping report. But it got scrubbed enough under intense tobacco lobbying and finally got adulterated enough that the bill's author withdrew it in May 2019. There's been several other smaller bills here and there. AB 131, introduced by our own Jordan Cunningham. It's not currently active. AB 1639 was just introduced in, that should say February 2019. And it is currently active. But as I was doing research for this presentation, the first thing that popped up when I typed into the Google machine was an LA Times article from earlier this month that says, new California vaping bill is a ruse for protecting big tobacco. And we know that Representative Gray receives significant funds from the tobacco industry. The last point I want to make is that we received a lot of accolades in San Luis for being the first city in the world to ban smoking in bars and restaurants. And that happened in 1990. It took 5 and 8 years for the state to adopt such regulations. So we were ahead of our time back then, and things take a lot longer to happen at the state level. So local cities and counties are taking matters into their own hands. We've had 41 cities and counties in California pass local flavor bans since 2010. And that also includes 200 cities and counties across the nation. And then just last week, Michigan, their public health state public health officer declared youth vaping an epidemic. And the governor said that she was going to take these products off the shelves. So that's the first state-level action we've seen. San Francisco received a lot of attention last year when they came out with a very comprehensive flavor ban. So when we look at these flavor bans, often there'll be exemptions, either exemptions for menthol and mint flavors or exemptions where they can only be sold in tobacco-only stores versus gas stations. San Francisco came out with a very comprehensive ban. It was also the largest city in California to have adopted such a ban. And so the tobacco industry came out with their with their gloves on. And they had it when the Board of Supervisors passed this ban. The tobacco industry was able to put it before a voter referendum, and the people of San Francisco upheld this. So San Francisco banned flavors, and then just recently this summer, they went a step further and said that they were going to ban the sale of e-cigarettes until the FDA reviewed the products and deemed them safe for public consumption. And then we have other cities in California, such as Beverly Hills, that said, well, why stop there? Why are we even selling the deadliest consumer product on the market? Beverly Hills, this also in June, banned the sale of tobacco entirely from their city. And there's other cities that I know of in Southern California that are also reviewing this policy as well. So what we're seeing in San Luis Obispo County is the same trends, vaping trends, that we're seeing across the nation and the state. The majority of students in our county say it's easy or very easy to get these products. And then, as I mentioned, we know that local retailers are violating the Tobacco 21 law. It's constantly pretty consistently around 15% of tobacco retailers. Also to note, the retailers most likely to be in violation of this law are the vape and tobacco shops, the retailers that are pushing higher volumes of these products out to the community. So we currently don't have any flavor bans in place in any of the cities or the county. But we have seen an increased interest in law enforcement. We've been working, for instance, with Morro Bay Police Department, who's got some state grants to increase their compliance checks in their community. We're really excited to work with them and support other cities who are looking to build that capacity and specifically address this issue with teen vaping. So the last slide I'm going to leave you with is a quote from the governor of Michigan, as she came out with this strong stance last week. I think it's powerful. I think it shows conviction. She says, as governor, my number one priority is keeping our kids safe. And right now, companies selling vaping products are using candy flavors to hook children on nicotine and misleading claims to promote the belief that these products are safe. That ends today. Our kids deserve leaders who are going to fight to protect them.
Thank you. The numbers are distressing.
Yes.
But they keep growing. So I'm sure we have questions starting down. Commissioner Campbell.
I don't know where to start on my list of questions. And just one comment. It's, having followed this for several months, it's really apparent that if anything's going to get done, it has to start at this level. It's amazing that only one state has really acted vigorously to deal with this. And my impression, and perhaps you could confirm this, is that the farther up you get the the various municipal and county and state government levels, the harder it is.
Right.
So it's really encouraging to see the interest here in the county, and I know you're working with a number of city governments. They've asked for your help in putting together these ordinances, and it's encouraging. I think it's going to happen. And I hate to take advantage of these recent deaths that we've been reading about, but if you'll excuse me for saying this, the timing couldn't be better.
Amy.
Hi, Inger. Thank you so much for this information. I have two questions for you. The first is, when you mentioned the child survey to come back around again for this year, I imagine a lot of those numbers must be underreported. So looking at some of these staggering figures, I imagine that we can inflate them a bit as well.
Yep, I would agree.
And which survey is that?
So the one that I showed on the graphic was the National Youth Tobacco Survey, and then we also locally use our California Healthy Kids Survey that is done biannually in the schools.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the likelihood of SB 38 being revisited is?
I think we have some really dedicated lawmakers in California that are going to keep putting these bills back on the docket, but I think it's a kind of a you miss every shot you don't take, and so they're going to keep putting these bills out, and hopefully one will finally pass. But, you know, the guidance we do get from our counterparts at the state is that we just need more support from the local communities. So even within the past year, I'm going to say we've had at least a dozen cities that have adopted these regulations, and that's just building momentum. It's showing lawmakers in Sacramento that there is support for these policies. And so I think what we've heard from other tobacco control programs across the state is that they're just going to move forward. You know, they can't afford to wait. And I think that that's really the message, is that, you know, I was here a year ago talking about these staggering numbers, and we're still waiting. There's only so much education you can do. I think one of the examples, you know, I revisit was just around Memorial Day, when seven students from Lewis Middle School in Paso Robles got sent to the hospital for vaping a product which turned out to be concentrated cannabis. And I, you know, was so frustrated at that point, because we'd done so much outreach with Paso Robles, the students and the parents, and education can really only go so far. And that's why we need to reform the retail community and make the availability of these products in our community that much harder to get. Mm-hmm.
What have you seen is being done in schools that's been most successful in Slo County?
I don't think we've seen a good solution in schools. I think every time I talk with school administrators, they are grasping for straws. I mean, we've heard about, not in our county, but we've heard about other schools trying to get vape detectors for bathrooms. We know that the bathroom plays a central role in this vaping epidemic, where kids are using these products. I was talking with Mary Jean earlier about schools that are limiting students from using the restroom facilities, which just goes to show, you know, vaping isn't just a health risk, but you're posing significant issues in the educational setting as well. If kids are being distracted, disruptive, can't get their if they're addicted to these products, mm-hmm. you know, it's taken away from the learning and educational opportunities as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming in. I have seen the advertisements on TV where they show it as brain poison.
Yeah.
I think that's a very effective tool. The last time you were here, I'm not sure if it was you or someone else, mentioned to us that parents initially bought some of these products for their kids because they thought it was a cessation mm-hmm. product. Have we made any progress in convincing them otherwise?
I think so. You know, I think that especially as Commissioner Campbell mentioned with the vaping deaths, you know, that's kind of busting that myth that these are harmless water vapors. But maybe it's too little too late. We had heard, yeah, that parents would go to the school administrators and ask for their products back after they'd been confiscated from the kids. I think more often, though, the parents are unaware that their kids might be using them. There's been some research lately that looks at peer groups, and which peer groups are more likely to use these vaping products. And due to these products being more of a tech object than anything else, popular peer group kids, so the kids that are high performing, the kids that are on the swim team and the basketball team in the leadership class, are actually the ones who are more likely to be using these. And these are the kids whose parents are saying, my kid would never smoke a cigarette. They wouldn't smoke a cigarette, but they'll use a vape device because the social pressures are so great.
Amazing. I'm a big proponent of compliance checks. Could you tell us, what is the penalty to a retailer that sells these things to minors?
So first offense in our county is a $1,000 fine. The second offense is a 15-day suspension and another $1,000 fine. Third offense is a 30-day suspension. And I can tell you that retailers, a $1,000 fine isn't that significant. They would rather pay probably $5,000 than go through that 15-day suspension. So that's really where we can hit them. But we do have multiple offenders or repeat offenders. So it's a significant issue that, you know, we stay on top of it as best we can, but noncompliance is a huge issue.
Thank you so much.
As you said, it's timely. I mean, just within the last week, to get at lung damage, permanent lung damage is something that we really have to make sure that people realize is something that can affect them, not just now, but forever. Mm-hmm. Is that something that, you know, we're, some of those commercials or not commercials, actually the commercials are like it's going to be something that will help you stop smoking, these vaping tools. That's for adults, and some of the kids, just the flavors. But to see in the news that there's lung damage, people dying and on respirators and things like that, is that something we can capture for that education piece?
Yeah, there's some really smart researchers working on with focus groups on kids on what key messages, you know, that students are receptive to. And I think a lot of the long-term lung damages are just go right over many youth's head. You know, it's hard to comprehend what's going to happen in 5 or 10 or 30 years. And that was, you know, what we were using with cigarettes. The stuff that's happening now, the very acute, you know, illnesses are a whole another matter. And maybe that will resonate with youth, but for the most part, long-term health impacts don't resonate with youth. They don't believe they're going to be addicted either, even though we know that these products are able to super concentrate the nicotine content into them.
Even seeing someone on a respirator and seeing what the lung damage looks like, I mean, they're showing x-rays on the TV. Is that something that the kids would respond to, you think?
We've tried it. We've tried throwing the whole kitchen sink at when we go into the classroom, but the three areas that research has shown that resonates with kids are talking about the chemicals, what chemicals we do know are in e-cigarettes. We have a generation now who's very aware of what they're putting in the body. We have a gluten-free generation, right, which is something that I wasn't, you know, as educated on when I was a student. So chemicals in the body, talking about signs of addiction. Again, we live in a society where people say I'm addicted to my cell phone or I'm addicted to junk food. And when I stand up here and say you're addicted to their Juul, they, you know, kind of brush that off. But if we can be smart about our messaging around addiction, then that's something that can resonate with youth. And then talking about vaping industry and looking at their sales rates and how that's really aligned with youth e-cigarette use. Those are three areas that research has shown to resonate with youth. But it's hard to communicate the message, especially when on the counter side, you have all the peer pressure to use these products.
Thank you so much for your presentation. It's frustrating to hear about the patchwork nature of the various laws. I wonder, is there any movement at the county level rather than just going Morro Bay and Grover Beach and all mm-hmm. of that to get something going?
Yeah, I mean, we do outreach. We do community events. We work with our coalition to build kind of grassroots support. So it's organizing the parents when we get calls saying, you know, mothers and fathers crying, saying that they found their kid who they never thought would vape. So our role at the Tobacco Control Program is to find those strong champions for the policy and then connect them with the policymakers. Mm-hmm. So that's why it kind of looks somewhat patchwork. We also know that in our discussions with the cities, it seems like everyone's kind of waiting for the next city to be the first one to do it before they adopt it themselves.
Right, and that was by no means a criticism of you, just hearing about it, because I know kids are, you know, pretty ingenious and can get things where they want to. So,
And it really does need to be, you know, a regional approach, because obviously we, you know, each city can control the products that are being sold within their city limits, but
right.
there's the next city over. So, you know, and that's why I think a lot of cities are saying, well, we'll wait for the state to do it, because what's going to stop a kid from driving across? But we can't, you know, we can only control what we can control.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any questions, but thank you. And I recognize what a huge trip on home. recognize what a huge challenge it is. You know, years ago, many, many years ago, probably 40 years ago, for the American Lung Association, I taught a smoking cessation class as part of jobs I was doing. You know, we showed lungs with, you know, gook all over them. We did a lot of sensational things. Maybe we had some success. It wasn't geared for children. You know, it was an adult course. But, you know, having been a nurse for over 50 years and seen, of course, the havoc of cigarette smoking and vaping, I don't know so much about. My understanding was that there are different levels of nicotine in it, so you could wean by having one with less and one with less. I did think that, and I guess I still think that. It's just it's not probably likely or a good use of it. But anything at all, any efforts that you're making to stop our youth from even starting, that's the key. Mm-hmm. And I see the perils in the city, the patchwork, because if kids want to use vaping, if their city doesn't sell it, they're still going to get it. You know, that's just the way it is when you're growing up and you're trying to be a rebel or be who you are or not do what your elders tell you. So I think you have a huge challenge, and I appreciate everything you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good.
He has another.
Bob?
One question that just popped up again. You mentioned the rationale that these devices can be used to stop smoking actual cigarettes. How good is the data on that?
I'm glad you asked. So there was a group of researchers at Dartmouth Medical School who just came out with a population-level study where they plugged all their numbers into these models. And under best-case scenario, for every one adult that's able to quit using an e-cigarette, 80 youth are going to start using an e-cigarette that never would have smoked a cigarette in their life. So that's two school buses full of children. And anecdotally, you know, we've heard so-and-so quit smoking with e-cigarettes, but really we don't have any hard scientific proof yet. And that's why I think what San Francisco is doing is really smart, saying they may be good cessation aids, but why did you put them on the market without any evidence that they are actually going to do that? So it's hard to counteract some of those anecdotes we hear where, so-and-so was able to stop using, but there's really no scientific proof that they are better than cold turkey or hypnosis or acupuncture or any of those other non-FDA-approved cessation aids.
So other than being distressed that we do not have one single city in our county that bans flavors, I think we do have some grassroots work that needs to be done. I will tomorrow do what you have tasked me with, and we will get a hold of a couple of cities and start working with them. And you know, and I'll just promote what you were saying about everybody sitting waiting for somebody to be the first city. The last city council meeting that I went to, when they talked about city ordinance, the first question from two of the city council people were, well, what's everybody else doing? Who's the most comprehensive in our... And so then we discussed, well, was it St. Louis or was it Paso? Or, oh, well, I think Paso just passed at something. So, yeah, they are looking to see what everybody else is doing. So somebody has to be the first one. So I think we can... It's a huge task, and we need to work on it. So let us know what we can do as a commission to further support you and help you with that. And thanks again for coming this evening and keeping us up to date. Not great news, but it is news, and we need to all work on it. It is definitely an epidemic, and as Bob said, it's been in the news. It's just getting worse and worse and worse. So
thank you. Good.
All right. Thanks, Inger. Wow, two great presentations tonight, you guys. We're on a roll. So let's look to Dr. Bornstein for our public health report.
Thank you. Good evening. And I'm so glad that our youth and our parents stayed for that second presentation.
Yes.
Probably two things that I worry about a lot is concussion and the uptake of nicotine in our youth. So our youth leaders really have to be part of the solution. They are, but as both teams, we're, our tobacco control program manager as well as the youth, we're saying sometimes it's just really hard to get in there, and sometimes the real do-gooders and succeeders aren't the best messengers, though they try. So, we're going to keep coming at this at all different angles. We at the county level, I thank Inger for her patience. We are really the last to sort of get on expanding our restrictions on tobacco and other kinds of smoking devices, et cetera. At the county level, every other jurisdiction has moved something along, and so we are trying to move the needle in the county, and we'll continue to be working on that in the coming weeks and months, and hopefully it'll be a shorter timeline than we hope, but it really is. I know as a mom of two teenagers that it has really been hitting me hard to hear the news of late. I will give you, as is part of my presentation often, to give you the facts. I know that they are changing on a daily basis. So as of today, the news, it hit last Friday, hasn't been updated. But I think I mentioned at our last meeting just a month ago, we were looking at 100 cases of vaping-associated pulmonary injury and 20 cases in California. We are now standing at 450 cases nationally, 50 in California, and 5 deaths. One of those in Los Angeles. 5 cases in Los Angeles in recent, I don't know if it's week or weeks, but, and I think the message really is that there's so much we don't know about these products. This I liken it to other products that have come out with good intent, even if we believe that the tobacco companies had good intent for cessation reasons. I'll let that be a truth for the moment, but you know, whether it's pesticides or, you know, nausea for pregnant women, or in this case vaping devices, we do have a tendency in this country to allow the use of a product to get ahead of our information understanding of what kind of damage it can do. So So I do agree that, unfortunately, it takes a crisis sometimes to get the kind of attention that we need to. But it is an epidemic. It's a crisis. And those numbers, which are, I thought I was keeping up, but even I was shocked to see that we're talking over 1 in 5 high schoolers are actually using these devices. So, I'll leave it at that. Other things that are happening public health-wise in our community that I want to make you aware of, some good news. I don't think at this point it has anything to do with Planned Parenthood. Having said, no thank you, we're not going to take block grant family planning money. It's too soon for that redistribution to have happened, but we did unexpectedly get an announcement of about a 20% increase in our Title X family planning grant, and part of that was a bonus for having done good documentation and follow through on our STD cases. So I wanted to toot our own horn. Some of the money comes as a bonus, and some I'm not sure where, and there may be if there is a redistribution of the 40% of all the federal dollars that are aimed at family planning in this country do, in fact, get redistributed. That will be a loss in terms of there being enough capacity in the other providers to potentially pick up the full continuum of care from Planned Parenthood, but it may mean that we will grow our services if that does come to pass. So that was one piece of news. There is a new information out today, another finding in some water wells of a new, it's not a new chemical by any stretch, it goes back probably 80 years or so, but the state and the US EPA have been looking at a new testing methodology for something called PFAS, perfluorochlorinated acid, and another product that it's not rolling off the tongue. But there's been some testing done in our area as well as across the country, and we're just now getting these results. And unfortunately, because the chemicals, which are man-made and seem to last forever, there's no breakdown. Were used in industries that happen around airports, happen around landfills, et cetera, with the same community that has been affected by TCE, which we've talked a lot about before here. The trichloroethylene in the area, not far from the airport, we're seeing some of the same effects in that same area of our county. So stay tuned. I'm sure there'll be news coming out on this shortly, but... and the last, I have some other staff issues to say, but the last public health news I wanted to just announce is on October 16th at the French Copeland Pavilion. We public health, our community health improvement plan access to care team is working with our Heal Slow coalition to put together a health workforce education seminar. It's going to be looking at the full continuum of how do we deal with getting doctors of all ilk, including psychiatrists and dentists, to come and stay in our county. What about mid-level providers? Where are they coming from? And can we get in on the goods, whether it's, you know, loan repayment or other recruitment opportunities? And then to round out the continuum of care is looking at availability and utility of community health workers. So you may see it will not house everyone who may wish to come, but certainly our health commissioners are invited, and let me know if you would like to receive a formal invitation. It's a daytime. I know that doesn't work for some of you, but October 16th, noon to 3-ish. So, okay, and then finally I wanted to talk about a number of staffing issues that are happening in our department that are keeping me entertained, euphemism intended. Our nursing director, Pam Dudley, has announced her retirement after 39-plus years, and that is going to be happening by the end of the year. So that position is now posted, and I'm trying to put the word out as far and wide as is possible, nationally, statewide, and locally, to any nurses with an interest in public health who have a management background as well. So you need to be a public health nurse. You need to have 4 years of supervisory experience. So I know some of you are or know nurses, and, help me get the word out on that. We did fill our other, our vacant division manager position, which is in health promotion, and Elizabeth, or Liz as she goes by, Merson, has taken on that position, and that she is Inger, who you just heard from's new direct supervisor. So within that division, just to remind you, is our tobacco control program, injury prevention, oral health, our WIC program, and community wellness, which addresses, again, healthy eating and active living and nutrition, et cetera. So, she started last week, and she comes out of our own agency where she was the director. You've heard from her previously as the director of public health emergency preparedness, so that leaves us a hole there. So we have already begun the recruitment process for that position. And then finally, I want to talk a little bit about the change for your commission support that is taking place, as evidenced tonight by someone sitting alongside Teresa. Teresa's not going anywhere. She's staying in our department, and we're very, very happy about that. We're just changing up some of the roles and responsibilities of our administrative staff, and Teresa has taken on quite a number of other administrative responsibilities, particularly as a supply clerk for our entire clinic system. And so Mike Coughlin, who you see sitting with her, is getting his initiation to Health Commission tonight, and will continue to be the support person for the Health Commission as we go forward. So with that, I will turn it back over to you.
Anybody have questions for Dr. Bornstein?
I do.
Go ahead.
Do we have a schedule for the flu shots this year?
I'm sorry, I'm hesitating. So I, off the top of my head, I think our this year the county is doing the first responder clinics, which means that we're in four places throughout the county, and I believe it's happening. I don't have the data on my tip of my tongue. It's in early November, and the reason for that, we had every intention of moving it earlier this year, but we got information about delays in the pipeline, and so we wanted to be sure to have our sufficient supply when we did it, so we moved it back a little bit. Folks who deliver flu vaccine, whether it's your primary care doctor or pharmacies or hospitals, sometimes do clinics. I don't know in general what their overall schedule is going to look like, but things might tend to be a little bit later this year because there was a little bit of a manufacturing problem with one of the products. You do, though, remind me to tell you another good thing that's happening this year is that we're expanding the health officer's order about which healthcare entities are going to be required to either have their staff get flu vaccine or wear a mask while doing patient care services while on duty, and we've expanded it to the EMS arena. So you may see more paramedics show up at it. Hopefully you won't see any paramedics show up at your door, but members of the community may in fact see, hopefully they won't, because everyone will just get their flu shot and be done. But for those who wish to decline the flu shot, we're not holding down any firefighters or paramedics. But if they choose not to get the vaccine, then they will be required to wear a mask during patient care. So you may see a little bit more masking. But so now we've got on board hospitals, long-term care facilities, outpatient clinics, and urgent care and EMS. So thank you.
Thanks. Any other questions?
I think CVS has their signs up all over. They're doing a lot of the pharmacies are doing the
Walmart,
the flu shots now, and then you can get your coupon for $5 off or whatever it is that they're doing. But the important thing is get your flu shot. So, good. All right, let's move on to health commissioner updates. Let's start to my right, Amy.
So I attended the Heal Slow Healthy Communities meeting and met Liz last week. That was September 5th, and they talked about the October 16th meeting the demand for healthcare in this county. So I look forward to hopefully attending that. We also talked about health and transportation corridor planning and looking at multi-agency corridor planning between Santa Margarita down to Santa Maria, looking at how the built environment is affecting most of our transportation, access to care, quality of life, access to services, particulate matter up and down the corridor. Very interesting. And then one of the things that they discussed was really having an impact in some of these proposals and ordinances that the county looks at is meeting with architects before it goes to city planning so that you have an opportunity to have valued input rather than sort of more of an ambush approach at the end when it's really tight to sort of backpedal and make those modifications. So I hope that we're able to solidify some meetings with some planning officers and really make sure that those that information is well received at the beginning when community input can be valued and modified the plan a bit more.
Thank you for attending that meeting. Commissioner Campbell?
Well, we got a very thorough update on the tobacco control scene tonight, so I'll skip that part of my presentation. My other responsibility is with the Oceano Dunes pollution abatement, and there are some big dates coming up, and I think they'll be very telling as to how they work out. August 1st, the state parks presented their first draft of the 2019 annual report and work plan for preliminary evaluation by the Air Pollution Control Officer and his scientific advisory group. Both of those entities, Gary Willey and the scientific advisory group, felt like what State Parks was proposing was 25 to maybe 35% of what they would need to do to meet their schedule to reduce emissions by 50% in 4 years, so in 2022. So this Friday, State Parks is to introduce their revision based on the comments they've got, and that will be published, and so it'll be available to anybody who wants to read it. And then October 1st, there'll be a public workshop where the public can present their comments. And following that, Gary Willey has 10 days to decide whether or not to accept the present plan. If he doesn't, there's this very complicated sort of series of steps to deal with that. And I think it'd be really worthwhile following those meetings and Gary's response. I think we'll learn a lot about how successful this abatement order is going to be or not.
Catherine.
Well, thank you. I really need to focus on the one meeting that I attended this month, or actually late last month, was the Suicide Prevention Council. And September is National Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And in fact, tomorrow is National Suicide Prevention Day. There's some activities going on this month and next month. One in particular is October 2nd at the Palm Theater, Park Theater in Paso Robles will be showing the movie The S Word. And it will be attended by the director. And it's free to the public. It's from 6 to 8 p.m. And the director will be there. A survivor panel will be there. And behavioral health professionals will be there. And I'm very excited about that. They're thrilled to have this opportunity. They're also putting together a walk to fight suicide. That's going to be on October 12th. And you can register for that online. But they've also come up with a brochure that I'm extremely pleased with. It's called After Losing a Loved One, a Support Guide for Suicide Loss Survivors in San Luis Obispo County. And they're distributing this all over the county in places where you would come in contact with a suicide loss survivor. And it's filled with a lot of really good information. There are also a couple of suicide loss survivor support groups springing up in the county, I'm happy to report, and I'll have more information as those come together.
Thank you.
Jean?
No report this month.
You didn't do anything this month?
I don't have all the details here.
Candace?
So I attended the International Overdose Awareness event. I apologize for not having advertised it since I wasn't here in the last meeting. But it was an excellent, well-attended event. There were probably over 50 or 60 people. It was hosted by the Friends meeting group, the Quakers. And there were recovery and treatment groups. Drug and Alcohol Services was there. Slow Hospice was there. The Syringe Exchange provided overdose prevention education and naloxone trainings. And then there was a really lovely remembrance of folks who have passed from overdose. So it was just an excellent event at the library. So I was happy to do that. I will also this month be going to a statewide syringe exchange meeting at the beginning of October, so I'll let you know about that. But I know one thing that's coming from that is that there's a statewide push to fund syringe access programs doing more hepatitis C linkage to care. And so we're going to be getting the details about how to get that money. So,
thank you. Lisa?
I have no report this month.
Good. I have just one thing to report. Dr. Bornstein mentioned the Heal Slow upcoming meeting in October to talk about our healthcare workforce in the county. The other thing I have is the human trafficking. There is a human trafficking event coming up in San Luis Obispo. It's all the partners that have been working on human trafficking, both labor and sex trafficking, here on the Central Coast. It is Saturday, September 28th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Mind Body Plaza on, Broad Street in Tank Farm Road. They will have, our district attorney Dan Dow will be a speaker, and there's a survivor, thriver, and advocate from the from a Fresno organization called Breaking the Chain that will speak as well. I think this is a they don't say if it's a free event or not, but it says to purchase tickets. So I assume that there might be a, because it is actually a barbecue, there might be a small fee to attend or whatever. But if anybody is interested, I have the website where you can register to attend. And that's all I have. I didn't make the human trafficking meeting last week. I'll try to do it in one of the upcoming events. So, and the our Emergency Disaster Coalition did not meet. It's coming up next week, and I guess Liz probably won't be there with us. So good. I'm delighted to hear that she got the position. Do any of our other standing committees have reports? Budget? Of course, there's no money. There's nothing to talk about there, right? Legislative? Amy, anything?
Sure. A couple highlights. I can start with a federal update. Timely, speaking of e-cigarettes. One thing I was looking into was that back in March, the FDA announced new flavored e-cigarette sale restrictions and opened up a 30-day comment period that ended back in July 2019. So hopefully in the next few months, as those comments and public comment period is now closed, hopefully we have some information on guidelines that they will come out with, but likely will take some time.
It's always interesting to see the comments, because there's always both.
And that is with the goal to protect youth tobacco access along the way. Also, that New York recently passed and joined the 18 other states who are Tobacco 21 legislation. On a state level, California is now looking at a Senate Health Committee bill that would impose less favorable benefit on limitations for mental health and or substance abuse disorders. Particularly those that are coming targeted for healthcare service and health insurance companies, which is a federal law. It was enacted in 2008, so California is looking at making that more imposed from the state of California. And then locally, Carpinteria is actually having a meeting tonight looking at considering banning flavored tobacco, which was a collaboration between Future Leaders of America and then City Council.
Good. Community education. Candace, do you want to
Sure. We met and talked about ways to increase our visibility as a commission, things that we can do around, I guess, advertising our topics and getting more folks here to comment and participate and hopefully also guide kind of the topics that we choose. So we also further talked about maybe doing, and we can discuss more in planning meeting, but doing more of a thematic kind of series of topics that would relate to one another so we can dig a little deeper into something like social determinants of health or something like that. So that's all, I guess.
Okay, good. Thank you. It was a good meeting. Lively discussion. Nominating. For once, our commission is full. There's nothing for the nominating committee to do right now, so good. Next item is the approval of our minutes from our last meeting, which was August 12th, 2019. Anybody have any corrections, additions, or comments?
I do. Catherine? I do. Under the Health Commission, Health Commissioner updates, under mine, I just wanted to clarify that Dr. Tran is one of the few doctors available in the county for the treatment of Medi-Cal eligible children. And I want to make that clear because there's a lot of dentists in the county who will treat children, but he's one of the few that will specifically take Medi-Cal.
Dentical.
Is it Dentical? Mm-hmm.
Dentical.
Dentical?
Same thing.
I'd only
thing,
heard Medi-Cal. Okay.
Yeah. The
right. Thank you. Thank you.
Good. And are we still thinking of trying to get him to be a speaker some upcoming meeting?
Somehow.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
All right. So with that clarification, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes? Lisa, second?
Second.
Anybody? Okay. All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Okay. They are approved. Prospective items. I have just one announcement that we'd like to make. On our after our planning meeting, we were planning to do next month would be our topic would be housing. And then the following one would be vaccines, if it's okay with everybody, and I think it probably will be. We'd like to switch those. Vaccines in October, it's a timely time with flu vaccine and other things, and then move housing to November. Anybody have any? Okay, then I think we will go with that. Anybody have anything else this evening? If not, again, congratulations, ladies. Thank you so much for coming with us. Did you have something, Catherine?
I just wondered why we're having it on the 21st.
Oh, as a reminder, thank you for reminding me. The reason we're our next meeting is the third Monday in October is the second Monday is a holiday. Columbus Day, I believe. And so you're a county, a former county employee, but Catherine. You didn't know that?
I would have come.
You would have come. So, yes, so it's the third Monday in October. So, okay. Good. With that, I think we'll be adjourned for this evening. Thank you all. I'm glad you mentioned that.